Welcome to the fourth episode of the Wonder and Awe podcast. I'm Louis Schwartzberg, and I'm going to be your host. Many of you already know me from the films I've made that celebrate life, making the invisible visible by taking viewers on journeys through time and scale. And we focus on important planetary issues, like my recent film, Fantastic Fungi. My work has always combined the how of science and the why of art. And I've always seen wonder and awe as that intersection between art and science. And this podcast fills that sweet spot. But what I've learned over the so many years of experience in making is that immersion in nature increases our capacity for courage, creativity, kindness, and compassion, the components we need to save our world. That's why I'm also proud that today's podcast is sponsored by the Fetzer Institute. They're helping to build a spiritual foundation for a loving world. Fetzer's new study, What Does Spirituality Mean to Us?, reveals how spirituality informs our understanding of ourselves and each other and inspires us to take action for the common good. You can explore these findings and more at spiritualitystudy.org. My two guests today have spent decades as leaders and mentors in the visionary art movement, and together they co-founded the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors, a sanctuary of visionary art to inspire every pilgrim's creative path and affirm the values of love and wisdom. First, I'd like to welcome my dear friend Alex Gray to the Wonder and Awe podcast. His renowned work has been exhibited around the world, including the New Museum and the Stux Gallery in New York City, the Museum of Contemporary Art San Diego, the Grand Palais in Paris, the San Paolo Biennial, and the ARC Exhibition Space in Tokyo. His art's been featured in venues as diverse as album covers for the Beastie Boys, Nirvana, and Tool, Newsweek magazine, and the Discovery Channel. He's also the author of several books, including Sacred Mirrors, Net of Being, and Transfigurations. Today, I'm also proud to welcome my dear friend, Allison Gray, to the podcast. Allison is a conceptual abstract painter and co-founder of COSM, Chapel of Sacred Mirrors. For many years, she's been a mentor and influencer of the contemporary visionary art movement. Since 1975, she has shared a studio and has been a partner of Alex Gray. Together, they co-host COSM Podcast. In addition to being a committed painter and a social sculptor, Allison has edited the first draft of Alex's books and is a co-chief editor of the COSM Journal of Visionary Culture. She's also written and edited countless articles and interviews throughout the Gray's partnership, including the long-running blog, Ask Allison About Art and Life. I'd like to invite you, all our viewers today, to share your questions for our guests throughout the live broadcast. Please submit your question in the comments section of this live stream broadcast and let me know where in the world you're coming from. Our team will be reading them all. And don't forget to tell us where you're writing from, okay? So we can feel this incredible global mycelial connection. Allison and Alex, you've both been key mentors and leaders in the visionary art movement for decades. Could you both briefly describe this revolutionary movement for our guests? And I'd like to start with you, Alex.
Me?
Sure.
Well, I think that the tribe of artists that we're most deeply connected with are artists that have been deeply inspired by their psychedelic mystical experiences. And we now know through the psilocybin studies that the mystical experience is one of the most profound healing kind of events in a person's life. And it's a highly visual and symbolic kind of transmission. I like to call it an art theology that takes place in the mind of the person who's undergoing this experience. And so some of these impressions are very, you know, they scorch into your soul, and you and these are the kinds of images that the artists, the visionary artists, have been laboring to try to bring in a lot of different ways. You see, I think visionary art is a way of seeing. It's not a style, you know, in the typical way. You can find abstract visionary art, like Allison's right. work, which I think is about the transcendental light. My own work, I think, has the same subject, you know, but it's looking at a multi-perspectival view of reality, a more integral map of reality. But it starts with, you know, consciousness and the idea that all art is really comes out of an artist's consciousness. That is the pure medium of art, is consciousness, and everything else is the medium. And so the medium of visionary art, I think, has been a lens into this mystical reality, which has been the subject of sacred art for millennia.
Allison, your thoughts on visionary art?
My thoughts on visionary art. Well, very early on, in 1976, Alex and I had a simultaneous LSD experience that where we saw the same toroidal energy fountains and drains, the vast vista of which each of us were a node and an interconnected, you know, fountain of light. And we both felt that, you know, having seen this vision was sort of more important than any other subject we could address. And we both, you know, in a very circuitous and windy way, set out to satisfy the articulation in our art of this inner space beyond space and time. So Alex's work and my work have felt, before that our work was about the self, very much so, because we were very young, we were in our early 20s, but then it became about this, you know, this space beyond space and time. And so I think that that's where visionary art comes from, and that the visionary art movement has grown out of the people who have had psychedelic experiences and want to express their visions. They also want to gather and get together and talk about and create around their visions, because it makes you want to be creative. A lot of creative people that we know have found this to be true, that it makes you even more creative, and then you manifest things. It's not just like, oh yeah, it's like in your head. If you have the wherewithal, you make things happen. So that's where I think the visionary art tribe came out of, was, you know, the 60s and the you know, the psychedelic movement. And Alex and I have just been around longer. You know, I started doing those experiences in 1969, and I went to art school and met Alex in art school. And, you know, we both are committed to the inner visions of visionary realm.
It seems like it's also having, I think it's blossoming right now in our culture in so many different ways. You know, visionary art, if it encourages that inner light, I've heard, Alex, you talk about that in so many eloquent ways. I was just wondering, how can our listeners discover that inner sight in their own lives?
Well, it's actually, I think, hard to miss. And people who'd be tuning into this network probably know very well how to tune into their inner light. You know, but there's so many ways. You know, it's just like, frankly, God's got the place surrounded, so you can't go very far before you bump into, you know, the boundless one, you know. And I think that the sure, tried and true ways have been meditation, you know, for thousands and thousands of years. You know, even Bodhidharma, though, would enhance his meditation with some green tea. He was a real tea advocate. Now, there are other meditational enhancements that one could get into, but the pure looking within and just simply envisioning the light in one's heart, I think that this is the most centering kind of thing, that when we breathe in and imagine this light in our hearts and this kind of toroidal flow of light that you could imagine flowing around you from this light in your center, you know, to encompass your entire physical body as a, you know, inner kind of meditation. You know, you may just, you know, see if you can feel that kind of updraft, a fountain of light that comes through your heart center that is the light, and then circles around you and comes back up and things. It's a fun kind of meditational light. If you can do that and kind of hold that kind of magnetic field, you know, where the spine is like the magnet, you know, and it's just kind of sending off these lines of force, then with that sense of a force field and seeing every other being that exists in all dimensions as having the same kind of little battery of light, and you being connected, all sharing that same light. See, that's a great way of both having a center, a little dot of light, you know, and a sense of this toroidal topology, and then you just extend that infinitely, and there you have a very abstract but also coherent kind of energy connectedness, you know.
Beautiful. That's so beautiful. Allison, you've written Ask Allison blog for many years, and you've mentored people.
Just 1 second, Louis. Sure. I'd like to answer the question about how do you trigger the mystical experience.
Sure.
Isn't that the question?
Yes.
I just wanted to quickly say that, you know, that the Johns Hopkins experiment does prove, several double-blind experiments prove that you can have a mystical experience. 65% of people in one dose of psilocybin in the right set and setting, that means the mindset on having the mystical experience and the setting of comfort and support and peace will trigger a full-blown mystical experience. So if people are wondering, you know, how do you have that, the visionary experience, that's been, you know, science. But then you were talking about my blog, Ask Allison. You can write to me, and people do all the time. I've been answering people's questions about art and life for, oh, probably 15 or so years.
That's great. Yeah. So I'd like to cue up the Stone Day painting. You know, in my film, Fantastic Fungi, we explored the stoned ape theory. And you have this wonderful painting called The Stoned Ape, showing a hominid holding a mushroom. Can you tell me what inspired that painting and how magic mushrooms, you know, have always inspired your art? I think you almost told or shared with me once, it's a vitamin we've been all been missing. But it's out there to help us.
Yeah, I like to call it vitamin C, S-E-E. And well, the caveman there, I mean, I had been exploring the subject of Adam and Eve and looking at the dawn human as a way of evoking a sense of the evolutionary trajectory that we're familiar with in science, you know. And so the connectedness with this, you know, sweep of time, and with linking both the evolutionary and the creation myth, I was toying with that archetype of the early and first man and woman and stuff. So here, this was called the visionary origin of language. And it's kind of like a cornucopia of symbol pictures are extruded out from the mouth of this dawn human who's making vocalizations. And they're starting to see the what would become alphabets, you know, for a later and more coordinated artist. But these early kind of dawn humans were probably the first artists as well. And they would hear little sweet everythings being chattered into their ears by hyperdimensional elf type beings that I have dancing on the psilocybin mushroom there.
That's great. That's beautiful.
And of course, that was greatly inspired by Terence. I think the painting was done in the like late 80s or something like that. And Terence McKenna and was a friend of friends and of really of Allison's sister. And so we had been reading some of his early work, he and Dennis, and which had a lot to do with psilocybin and La Chirera and all that.
Wow. So we're in this incredible, you know, time of this pandemic. And I think a lot of people right now are feeling a little bit out of balance. You know, it's a time of uncertainty, fear, anxiety. And so how do we pull out of this negative spiral? I think that for me, when you experience wonder and awe, you know, you become present and you can experience the divine. And for me, it engenders gratitude, you know, gratitude for life, for all living beings. It's this overwhelming sense of joy to be part of nature's wonders, inspiring curiosity, patience, and compassion, feeling small in a grand universe. In fact, blowing your mind is a medicinal and it's good for your soul. And Alex, I remember you saying that one of the greatest ways to expand your mind is looking at art. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, you might say that art gives a person the opportunity to transcend themselves. And that's kind of a mini mystical experience, really, you know, to get out of your ego head and get into the kind of head that might have birthed whatever art is being presented to you, because you basically try on that lens of into the reality that that artist is looking through. And so if it's some art that you've never seen before, then to me that qualifies as at least a tiny expansion of your consciousness, because now there's a new kind of graphic language that's mapped onto your brain, you know, that's mapped into your symbol systems, you know, like, I'd never thought of things in that way before. And it's really, I think that the way that we see things can alter our way of seeing the world, you know, and seeing and being are, I think, very deeply connected. Our worldview and what we're moving toward, what our future kind of contains, is really what I think draws us forward with courage. And at this time, yes, as you said, the multiple kind of dimensions of the human and life web dilemma, you know, that we have co-created has been a great awakening, I think, for some. And for some, it's been a cause to numb, you know. And so I think that that's dangerous, you know. It's like having an argument on the deck of the Titanic as the iceberg looms, you know. It's like, there's the iceberg, folks, you know. Let's settle this dispute after we steer away from the iceberg. Okay, let's all get agreement on that. So I think that we're in the period of, you know, turning the, we're trying to grab a hold of the wheel so that we can steer away from the iceberg.
Alison, I love the your painting that's behind you. And I know you have, you had a deeply mystical experience and discovered the secret writing that reoccurred throughout your work. Can you describe that experience briefly? Like, did wonder and awe play a part in that revelation?
Oh my God. Well, I started taking, experimenting with LSD primarily and other psychedelics when I was 17 in 1969. And then 3 years later, Ram Dass, and I did all kinds of things, you know, and tried all sorts of, you know, bicycling with friends and dance, going to dances and, you know, everything that everybody does, recreationally, campfires. But then Ram Dass came out with his book, Be Here Now. And reading that, I was very influenced and, you know, that he basically recommended, or he spoke of seeing the white light around going into a dark room. I mean, before Terence recommended the dark room, Ram Dass in 1971 wrote about it in Be Here Now. And I read that and I tried that. I tried it in a new setting that I had never tried it in before, a dark room, you know, go inside, my friend. So anyway, so I did. And just like those 65% of people at Johns Hopkins, you know, had a mystical experience, I was one of those. I chose the right set and setting, and the intention is very important too. You know, to set your intention of what you want to, you know, if you have questions and things, it's great to get those answered in that, in the space of that. So so I took when I took the LSD there in my room, what I saw, and I was an agnostic Jew. I was a political agnostic Jew in the time of Vietnam and, you know, and draft and everything like that, and women's movement. And so I didn't see God in my life, but then I saw God in that room, see? And the way I got the communication that it was God and that it, you know, from God, was through the secret writing. I saw secret writing wafting in the air, and I saw it sort of hovering and covering and, you know, around all surfaces. It was kind of creating the shape of everything, and it was going over my body. So it embedded in my work secretly, frankly, because in those days it was very dangerous. So you couldn't go to school and talk to your review board about LSD. That was just, it's hard for people to understand that now, but it would have been censured for that at Tufts University. I couldn't just go around talking about that. Right. So I hid that. Until, you know, really until Alex came into my life 3 years later, and he had that experience of seeing God in his first LSD experience ever. I mean, that's Alex. It was like one LSD experience on my couch in my house at my party, and he had a full-blown God contact. So when we met on this because I hadn't really had the feeling that I could talk to anybody else about it, and it connected us in 1975.
Yeah, well, I think it connected me to you guys as well, because right? Probably in 1970 I took my first trip, and it has certainly influenced my filmmaking. I mean, you know, I love, you know, taking people on journeys through time and scale, and making the ordinary extraordinary, staring at a blade of grass. And that's why I don't shoot normal movies. I can't shoot 24 frames per second, because I want to be able to share with people that vision of God that you so beautifully spoke about. It becomes your life mission. Like, once you see it, you want to share it, right?
And that's right.
You just can't stop.
Well, Louis, you've been revealing the unseen world really for as long as you've been a filmmaker. I think your experimental films back in college, and then Altered States was one of the first credits I saw in your work. Oh, look at Alison's secret language.
Oh, beautiful. Wow. Yeah.
Yay.
It was wafting through the air.
Oh, magic.
And Alex brought it in. He said, oh dear. But anyway, yeah. No, yeah. I have a secret writing, but I also have chaos and I have order. And order is like the universal mind lattice, you know, from the top, multicolored. I'm telling you, just for me, like looking down the funnel, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But anyway, that was chaos, order, and secret writing. It came to me in LSD that's I could commit my entire life career to chaos, yeah, order, and secret writing. I still wouldn't be able to communicate it in enough ways.
So last week I was at Big Sur, and I was fortunate to be like on this cliff edge looking straight down at the ocean. Mm-hmm. And you know, there you are, 1,500 feet. I'm watching the kelp bed, this gold network, you know, and then one little white egret, a tiny little egret off in the corner, standing on the kelp bed, like walking on water. And then this blue aqua water is just like coming at me because I'm looking straight down at it. So it's like undulating. So I got the pattern of the kelp. I got the undulating water. I got the symbol of one little, you know, animal life force. Wow. And I'm like, I'm on a trip. It was just beautiful to be able to, you know, reconnect. And so, you know, for the viewers out there, it's like once you see it, you get it. You know, you don't have to trip many times because you're awakened to a certain way of looking, of vision. And it's easily triggered just by looking, I believe, at the rhythms and patterns of nature, at least for me, because I'm so visual. I can turn it on anytime I see those godlike patterns. And I see it in all of your work as well, which is so beautiful.
Thank you so much, Louis. I adore your moving art series. I mean, I have it on at any time, you know, just going, you know, music is behind me, whatever we're talking, but it's just like, it's so beautiful. I hope you keep doing that. I hope you keep putting it out there like that, because that's just, I mean, I love that sort of thing. I love documentary, just the style of, you know, I put on extreme sports sometimes, but I really love the moving image.
So, okay, I want to ask Alex a question. I know that you're a big fan of William Blake. I think you've called him your favorite visionary artist, poet, philosopher. And he wrote that gratitude is heaven itself. So, you know, for either one of you, I mean, what role does gratitude play in your life and in your work?
I feel like it's the most clear and sincere relatedness that one can have to cosmos. You know, how can you be a loving servant of the divine without first being grateful for being given the opportunity to incarnate? You know, you kind of have to, I guess, be beaten down to a point where the mere fact of existing for a little while on this miraculous planet, given whatever condition you have for your life, has been a privilege, and for which I'm really grateful. And, you know, I think at a certain point in my life, I certainly did not feel grateful for my life. And I had to get over that. And that's part of what helped heal me on Allison's couch those many years ago. But it also brought Allison and I together, which is a cause for my joy. And I feel it's also the connection with, because of the visionary vantage point on reality, a node, a dock in the physical world of a transcendental reality that is channeling through all of us, you know, all of the time. but it's most easily beheld in the eyes of the beloved. And so having a relationship that's special, one that has lasted 45 years,
yeah,
is a rare gift, you know, that has, I'm sure it's why God granted us the gift of those mystical experiences. Only a handful that we together, you know, had the same vision. But that's a, I mean, that blows your mind entirely if you accept that it's possible that two people had the same mystical experience at the same time. What does that say about consciousness, you know, that if it was an out-of-body kind of experience? It's later been confirmed by other people who've had similar kinds of out-of-body and, you know, altered state or near-death experiences. So these the realms of consciousness, which transcend the flesh, are, I guess, equally beautiful in some ways, and contact with them then gives you a vantage point of saying, it is so beautiful inside, why, and it's so infinite, why, it's just like the outside world, which is so beautiful and infinite. God made it pure, the same, you know, through and through. And I feel like when you reveal unseen worlds, Louis, in a time-lapse way to make them become visible, you're not making anything up there. Sometimes you're graphically enhancing a reality you know is present and things. And I think that's where special effects become a really wonderful addition in your work. But it's always done in more or less in the name of science or making a point that's true, because why is there any need to embellish the infinite one? You know, nature's perfect. And so, I don't know. That's why I so respect what you've done. And I believe that we share this kind of subject of a trying to reveal a sacred reality that's hidden all about us.
I'd like to answer the question about gratitude.
Yeah.
I'm very grateful, Alex, the source of my life. What would my life be? But in the message of gratitude, I was thinking gratitude is the cure. Gratitude is a practice for which we all fall short sometimes, most of us anyway. There's the Dalai Lama and people like this that are very special. But we all fall short from gratitude. But gratitude is the practice where you get relief from depression and anger. You know, you would, if you're feeling depressed and you start to think about the things that you appreciate, it alleviates your depression. So it is a practice. And, you know, like I say, a practice is not getting it right. A practice is trying over and over again. So you have to see whenever you fall short that it's just, you know, you've fallen short of your practice of appreciating. I'm depressed again. You know, that means that you're not looking for enough things to be appreciative of. It's like going outside of yourself. You know, getting outside of yourself is the way out of depression and anger.
Sometimes I think of it as a, sometimes I think it's like your hard drive. If you can fill it up with enough good stuff, there's no room for the bad stuff to get in there.
Yeah.
That's a practice as well.
It is. It really is.
And you know, Allison, we're both Jewish, and I'll share a little secret with you that I've developed in the last year. You know, when we were in like Hebrew school, we weren't allowed to write the word God. Remember that? It was like G-D, because
G-D, yeah.
Thy God in vain. And as a little 5 or 6 year old, it was like, oh my God, the power of that. It was like, if you wrote the word God, you couldn't throw away that piece of paper because you could get in like heavy duty sin trouble, you know? Mm-hmm. And so now, whenever I'm feeling down, I go to capital G for gratitude. It's my G spot.
There you go.
I just go to G. And then, you know, it represents God, it represents gratitude. And I just envisioned the capital letter G to overcome the fear I had of the small letter G dash D as something that you weren't able to do.
Well, don't you think that there's a lot of, resistance to the word G-O-D? There's a lot of resistance to people, because there was for me anyway. When I was an agnostic, it was kind of like, prove it, you know? I mean, yeah. I was doing all the Jewish things and going through all the Jewish things, but I was like, it's a way of, it's a people, right? But anyway, when I saw God, there was no denying it. And there was no unknowing it. You can't just say, oh, I didn't see God. You can say it, and you're lying. So in any case, it's a knowing. You can't convince other people of it. But I think that people are afraid of the word because of its past associations. And I just recommend getting rid of those, like act as if they don't exist. It's just the word that people use to describe that spirit, that experience of ineffability. Mm-hmm. And it's the unpronounceable name.
So
it's always,
go ahead.
It's always made me respect the tradition so much that they put so much power in the name, the unpronounceability of it, mm-hmm. And I've always associated your language with this unpronounceable name. It's the unpronounceable language,
Right.
Well, people want to pin a face on it or a meaning on it, or it's this the way, it's that way. And I really feel like if God is actually within, then it's unique for everyone. Okay. It's coming out in its own special way, very much the same and very different too. Conflict without, without conflict.
Yeah. So I recall that, Alex, I think you had some incredible experiences at Harvard learning the science of anatomy and, healing energies. I'm just curious, how did that influence your painting career?
Well, I've had a fascination with anatomy, I guess, since I was a child. My mother surprised me one day by pulling out a box and showing me some of my old drawings. And she said, this is the earliest one I know. And it was from around 5 years old. I might've been 5 or 6, I don't know, but it's a skeleton. And it looks like it's got a big head, like a 5-year old's head in proportion to the body. I have no idea how it was inspired, but it looked a little Halloweenish, And so then there's something from when I'm 9 or 10, and also the Grim Reaper and things like that. So I think that the sense of the mortality and also the anatomy has always been part of the subject matter of my work. And so there's also a great figurative art tradition in the West, of course, and in art in general. And trying to find anything new to say with figurative art is, practically impossible. And so I thought that, the problem of skin is that it gives you this, you're white, you're black, you're yellow, you're red, you're a certain racial archetype or stereotype or something. And was there any way past it at all, that we could take with the figurative art? And not that I've, successfully transcended it or anything, but the attempt by using the anatomy as the focal point was to choose a way of relating to the human being that was both scientifically oriented and determined, and also was transcended the flesh a little bit, made it a little more translucent. And then it left you, if you believed the translation of the body, perhaps you'd start to believe the idea of the energies around the body and going through the body that it's suggesting. So it was a way of getting the viewer on your side in terms of suggesting an unseen reality or a reality that you know is there, but you don't typically see it. And so by putting that in the viewer's mind, then they're willing, or more willing perhaps, to see this other unseen reality of the subtle realms, you know?
Yeah.
So I just wanted to add that Alex got an A++ on his anatomy final in art school. And that he would, you know, he became very interested in Boston when he was going to the museum school, in the Warren Anatomical Museum at Harvard Medical School, which was right down the road from the museum school. And he became so interested in the collection there that he was hired, and he worked there for 5 years. And he even did a painting, a portrait of John Collins Warren, the founder, ancient founder of the Harvard Medical School. And beautiful portrait. And but he took care of the Warren Anatomical Museum and worked in the morgue there, which also accepted donations of remains for the study by the medical students. So he oversaw and helped out in that department as well. So anyway, that's Alex's interest in the medical world. And he also worked as an assistant, a lab assistant in a very interesting experiment there at Harvard, but the behavioral medicine department. And the things that interest Alex, he turns them into, he finds a way to make money from them. And he always has learned as he's earned. And he became a medical illustrator out of that experience, and just got offered jobs and started doing them and supported Zena and I for a good 12, 15 years that way. So she was growing up. So it was, I loved being part of that, helping out and being his rep. I was his rep. I put his portfolio together and took it on the road, and he had more jobs than he wanted, really. He didn't really care for medical illustration after a while.
So. It sounds like when you follow your passion, you make money as a byproduct of doing great work, right?
Well, Alex has always had a string of fucking interesting jobs. Okay, I'm telling you. I mean, as a teenager, he painted fun houses. I mean, don't you think Alex would be perfect at that when he's 17 or so years old? And he was a billboard painter. I mean, a serious, like Columbus Outdoor Advertising billboard painter. And that was an incredible experience. So everywhere he went, he learned things. And then he worked at Harvard, and he was a studio assistant for our professor who I was dating. This is how we really met, okay? Because he was the studio assistant. That's how he made a living the year that we were in a class together. He worked for our professor. So I would see him in the studio. But anyway, that's the story of us. But he's always had interesting ways of earning. Yeah, me too. I love what we're doing at COSM, and it supports us.
Well, the unfolding, I guess when you follow your path, you never lose your way. And we're on this journey together. And when you find your mission, not only does it give you purpose in life, but it gives you sustenance. It teaches you how to live a creative life, which you both are a beautiful example of. It's really inspiring.
Thank you, Louie.
So, look, I had the pleasure of interviewing you guys a while ago at COSM. So I thought we could watch a little short piece together to introduce the beautiful work you are doing there to the folks that are watching this program. So let's take a little peek at that.
There's something subtle going on when people are interacting with works of art, and they have a power to lodge themselves in our consciousness, in our imaginations, and become a new lens, a new map through which we can see these new realities. They act as inspiration. You take away something, your mind is expanded. Looking at art is the safest way to expand your consciousness,
Alex and I met in art school in 1974, and we had a spiritual meeting in 1975.
And it profoundly changed our life. It was unforgettable and very influential to the people we became. Much more uplifted, more available to our own creativity. We've been in the room together for 40 years making art. There's not a day that we don't make art. And when you think about that, that is a spiritual practice.
When I look back over my earliest work, the best one is of a skeleton. I've been working with this theme of mortality, I think, all my life, because it's what haunts us. I started hanging around Harvard Medical. I was enrolled in the museum school just down the block, and I met a man there at Harvard who could appreciate the inquiring mind of an artist. He ran the Anatomy Museum, and that's where I really wanted to work. When you see dead bodies, it's kind of like, oh, all too soon, that will be me. You know, so you're confronted, slapped in the face with the great mystery. Like, who am I? What am I living for? What is life? Those are the kind of unanswerable questions, but the answer that you provide for them will give you a direction in life. So I think that my artwork was more of a spiritual thing, learning about what is the nature of the body and to peel away the fabric and to look underneath the surface. It's just a miraculous interwoven masterpiece.
My work comes from a essentialized worldview that, you know, all things are made of three elements. Chaos, order, and you have secret writing, which you can see in my work very clearly over here in these acrylic paintings. The secret writing is, Alex calls it, the language of creative manifestation. My take on it is that when you're tripping, if you're in the experience and you're seeing the umbrellas of heaven above and around you, and then you try to talk about it with your mouth noises that are symbolic and mean things, and other people have to interpret them through their rational mind. You try to talk about those spaces that are those inner realms, that order realm, that bliss realm, through this symbol language. You write about it, you make art about it. Alex does it so beautifully. Rumi does it in his poetry. The better your windows, the better your secret language, the better you're able to take those inner worlds and put them out in the objective universe.
When the explorers would go out to the Great West and they didn't have cameras, that they'd bring a painter along. And then they brought it back and showed people, and they were awestruck. Oh my God, how amazing that place is. The visionary artists are people that are going inside, venturing into their inner worlds, and then attempting to depict it and bringing back a glimpse of a multi-dimensional reality. The mushroom has been one of my favorite ways of communing with divine intelligence. It's deep in human history that humanity has always had a relationship with these sacred plants. And now it's a thing that is mushrooming all over the world. That calls for a new kind of depiction of these realms, which are so inspiring, so fantastic, so infinite. They seem to contain a message. Many of the visions that people have heal them. Their visionary mystical contact with the divine imagination goes to the root of their own alienation from life and love, and reconnects them to the real purpose and value of being alive. So If you can get in touch with the foundation of life and the source of reality through taking some mushrooms, then that seems like a part of the program for awakening consciousness, kind of like a vitamin we've been missing. There is a visionary mystical reality that we don't understand, but that is trying to help us.
Wow. I want to share some cool news with you guys. You know, yesterday I was in Santa Monica at the St. John's Hospital and the Pacific Neuroscience Institute. We're going to be doing a clinical trial where we're going to treat people with alcohol addiction and disorders with a giant 85-inch monitor of my visual healing combined with psilocybin.
Ooh.
As a treatment to be able to, you know, collect the data and see how it can help. Also, we want to do a clinical trial with all the people that are dealing with grief and that are grieving as well. And I had to kind of pinch myself. I said, I can't believe it. The room is called the Trip Room. It should be called the Louie Room. And I just can't believe this is happening in LA, because as you said, Allison, you couldn't tell people you took LSD for fear of going to jail, you know? And here I am in LA in a Catholic hospital where we are about to, you know, put people on a journey that'll heal them in one session. You know, treating them with a drug that is, you know, Schedule I illegal drug for addiction to alcohol, where they spend hundreds of billions of dollars a year promoting people to drink and creating, obviously, you know, a lot of unhealthy bodies and minds. Mm-hmm. We're making some progress little by little, you know?
Yes. Yes. Things have changed.
Yeah.
Things have definitely changed, and they are changing. It's very wonderful. And your support of mushrooms, and now there's all these initiatives to legalize mushrooms in various states. I mean, don't illegalize natural fungus. I mean, honestly,
it's crazy.
There's no sense in it. It won't. You just basically are supporting a black market. That's all. You just, you know, people want to feel better. So, you know, let them.
Yeah.
And I hope it also drives a lot of young people, you know, to the polls and vote, you know, because I think issues like cannabis and decriminalizing, you know, mushrooms, millennials who didn't grow up with the propaganda that we grew up with have a different worldview on it. And, you know, they see it in a much more, you know, like positive light, like why isn't this sacred medicine available without being, you know, prosecuted? So it's happening. What also seems to be happening is the development that at COSM. I was looking at Instagram the other day, and it looks like you're bringing in some giant pieces of art. Tell us what's going on.
Well, while we are completely an oasis here at COSM, we still have 20 people who live and work here, and you know, trusted people that live and eat in community here without really much contact, deliveries and things like that. So we have been very busy doing two things, basically, you know, making COSM TV happen, which is something that we also wanted to do so much before COVID. And really it was just, you know, the vernal equinox, late March, we just started doing the podcast, and we just started doing it, and we've been getting better at it. None of us knew how to do it or had really done much of it, although we did have we had a podcast host, a guy, and he was here to do programming, but, you know, he had done a podcast, so he became our podcast host. And then we had an editor. But we were putting it towards other things. And now we were going to do the full moons and the new moon art church. And we've been doing interviews as well. So every week we've been coming out with a new episode on Cosm TV for maybe the last 25 or 27 weeks. And so there's lots to look at, and we're getting better and better. Our most recent offering was our talk on the history and meaning of the Sacred Mirrors. And it took place inside the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors. I mean, we installed the Sacred Mirrors for the first time in 12 years. They have been in storage. And they were on view in Manhattan for 5 years on 27th Street. But we had to move them. And we moved up here. And we had to just prepare for 12 years for this to happen. This is extraordinary. So we did a memorial service in there for our dear friend James Orrock. And we've done, we've done some meetings in there and given some tours. And if you want to see our studio, we're going to have a members circle every month. We've been doing video, Zooming our members circle, and you can get on Cosm members circle, find out more about it. But that's how we contact people. Otherwise, we're sequestered here, and we're in an oasis, and we're very happy. It's beautiful. We're very lucky. We feel very blessed. We're extremely grateful. All that. How about you, Louie?
Well, I feel the same way. We've been sequestered here, but I've got a giant server with access to 2,000 hours of material, so I could be cranking here for 100 years, making more movies. But luckily, more fortunate than obviously so many others that have had to suffer through this. But in a way, it's been a good lesson to slow down. The traffic in LA is gone. The smog is gone. There are birds, which I never saw before, that have come back. I think it's a great opportunity for a reboot and a reset. We don't want to go back to normal, because normal wasn't very healthy and a lot of people were suffering. And what a beautiful lesson maybe Mother Nature is trying to teach us, that we can live more sustainably, we can live more consciously, where we can have less impact on the planet. And another giant lesson, how much we value interconnection. Well, the thing that hurts the most is not being able to be together with friends and family. And in Fantastic Fungi, I mean, the whole essence of the movie is the ending, the mycelial network, the idea that this underground network, a shared economy, not based on greed, enables ecosystems to flourish. It's nature's operating instructions. And what a beautiful model for us to follow. So I feel that these are great lessons for us to learn in this period. And I really hope we can do a reboot and a reset going forward to be more caring, loving, compassionate, learn from biomimicry. It's all there. It's all under our feet. Like you said earlier, God is all around us, We just have to open up our eyes and wake up and follow in the natural order of life.
And be grateful.
Yep, and be grateful. Totally. Amen.
Good things come to people who are grateful.
Absolutely. So, wow. I want to thank you guys for a really beautiful conversation. It's beautiful. I think it'll reverberate not only throughout the universe, but to a lot of people whose hearts and minds are open to receive a little bit of love. And I also want to thank our sponsors. A special thank you to the Fetzer Institute for sponsoring the podcast, and also to Ruth Westridge Foundation. They are an organization that supports change makers around the world and gives a voice to the unheard by bringing art into healthcare, which is so, so beautiful. I also wanted to thank my team, Leland, Annie, Courtney, everybody from Moving Art, and Bethany, Ron, Jason, and Sean from Magical Threads. It's been a gift to be able to, talk about art, talk about healing energy, and talk about how we can, spread love throughout these incredible, uncertain times. But I have a lot of hope and optimism that we're going to get through this, and it'll all be for a brighter and more grateful future. Thank you.
Thank you, Louie.
Thank you. Thank you, Louis.